Good afternoon. Thank you very much for inviting me to participate in this panel. I feel like the outsider, hopefully not completely. I will be talking about work that we have been doing in different parts of the world, especially in the Andean mountain regions of South America and in East Africa. And the reason I bring that in is because as we think about the human dimensions of resilience and adaptation, we need to understand what drives decisions in these particular contexts where there is a lot of change. And when we talk about transformational changes, we may be talking about migration, we may be talking about climate change that may impact the livelihoods of people. So I want to talk about decisions, uncertainty, and translational approaches. And so the first thing that I'll do is talk about livelihood decisions and how the context in which these decisions are being made matters. Then I'll talk about uncertainty, risk, and vulnerability. And finally, I'll talk a little bit about what translational research processes are, why they are important, and how do we go about them. But why this matters to us when we're thinking about the future and when we're thinking about adaptation? In many parts of the world, local knowledge has existed for centuries, and people have been able to adapt using that types of indicators and knowledge that they have. Many years ago, at the end of the 1990s, we were able to conduct research in rural communities in the highlands of Peru and Bolivia, and we were learning from them about the indicators that they use for decision-making to predict what will be the conditions of the farming for the coming year. And their indicators were pretty good, and actually some of the research has proven that those indicators really work. But what's happening right now is that in these contexts, there is a very fast pace of change driven by the changing climate in these contexts. So when people are making decisions, we need to take into account what are the objectives of those decision makers. Are we seeking to maximize profit? Are we seeking to maximize food security of our families? What is the main purpose of that decision? And we talk about that because if you are working in developing countries in the world, you may know that 80%, for example, of farmers, 80% of the population in Africa are farmers, and most of them are smallholder farmers, and many of them are women. So knowing that difference and that nuance in terms of who the decision makers are is important. Why do I talk about this, having come from a meeting just now on transitioning cereal systems to adapt to climate change, is the fact that we're working a lot in the sciences to develop models, crop models, integrated models, to try to use those for decision making. But if we don't understand what the objectives of the decision makers are, then we may end up with predictions and forms of putting together the models that are not really helpful to those decision makers. In many cases, decision makers are working in a nature of markets that don't work as well as they do in developed economies. An example, John is not here right now, John Reginald. He was talking at the beginning. He showed a graph that was really, or a diagram that was very interesting, in which there is the decision maker and there is all this policy environment, the markets for inputs and outputs, the information that's flowing. And he thought that that was daunting to him. And when he asked the farmers said that was great. There is an institutional setting for the practice of farming in the United States that works very well, especially when there are risks and when there are shocks to the system. In other contexts, that doesn't happen. And because that doesn't happen, there may be other decisions that are driving the behavior of smallholder farmers. So, for example, in landscape systems like the Altiplano of Bolivia and Peru, I'm talking about a high plateau in South America between 3,800 meters of elevation and 4,500 meters of elevation, you see a very diverse landscape in 250 kilometers, very different to the landscapes that we've been seeing here. And in those landscapes, you see a high diversity of livelihoods happening, and they're shaped by the altitude, the temperature, the rainfall, and the differences in temperature between day and night. You have pastoralists at very high elevations that can only do that. You have other areas like what I'm just showing that point to places where the temperature is rising, and farmers are starting to plant new varieties of crops where they only could have animals. You have other areas where potato production and cereals and rotational systems are still being used. In other contexts where irrigation is bringing an opportunity for onion productions and very intensive systems, changing that diversification that was instrumental in trying to develop and manage risk in those areas. And then you have areas where there is a lot of immigration to these particular regions because they're very, very less harsh than other areas in the mountain regions. But as a consequence, you now have very small plots of land and more fragmentation. And finally, you have other areas where policies have been instrumental in changing the landscape, where dairy production is now possible because alfalfa fields are replacing some of the potato fields that were traditionally grown in that area, changing again the landscape systems. In this context, you have the other point, uncertainty, risk, and vulnerability. The team that I've been working with, which is interdisciplinary, has people in the atmospheric sciences that have been looking at the trends and projections for this particular region and also have seen the trends that have happened in the last 30 years. And so what they're looking at is that in the past 50 years, there has been a temperature change of 1 degree Celsius. That's really, you can see it in the way that cropping has been moving up the areas. You also see that there are projections for this particular region by the end of century that show a drier spring when you're planting and a wetter summer with an increase in average mean temperature of 4 degrees Celsius. In this particular area, you also are going to see the analysis are showing more extreme events than precipitation. And that's why you see more projections of more loss of soil moisture by the end of the century, even during wetter years. So intense events in very short periods where the soils are not able to capture the moisture that's coming down. And at the same time, we're finding that today there are areas that are really valuable to maintain ecosystems resilience. The peat bogs, for example, in these particular regions are key to the adaptation and provide environmental services. You have practices of fallowing that do restore the carbon, and unfortunately, my colleague Peter Morabali, if you know him, ask him about this because he was instrumental in doing this research in these ecosystems. But the practices or traditional practices that were used in this area and some farmers continue to use are very instrumental in maintaining this buffer that's the soil when this warming is taking place. So what we find in these areas is, I think I skipped something. Okay, so I wanted to now couple these risks in context with what's happening with the perceptions of people about their context. And why do we want to understand perceptions? As we know, perceptions are normally what guide our decisions. And it's not only happening in developing countries, it also happens in the U.S., as a colleague, J.D. Wolforce, was talking about last year in this conference, who's doing research in Washington State, looking at the perceptions of farmers in these areas. And these are perceptions that drive their decisions. What we find in these areas that I showed you is that both in the northern and central regions of the Altiplano, there are multiple events happening at the same time. This is just data for 2008, in which the households that were interviewed were hammered with hail, frost, drought, floods, changing climate, which was one of the perceptions for them a concern. And then at the same time, the market incentives, very low prices for crops, low prices for the livestock that they can sell, and then sometimes blockades that are a problem when they're trying to sell their products in the local markets. So multiple shocks happening in both regions, but a lot of diversity in how these shocks present themselves to the households. And just as an example, in the Central Altiplano, where the dairy production is starting, has been growing since the early 1990s, what you see is there is an increase in the average income for the household, an average of $3,000 a year, both in cash and kind. They have higher levels of education than in other parts of the Altiplano, and they actually have the ability to leave their land in fallow because they have enough land that allows them to have for a rotational system that allows for their land to be around 4 to 5 years in fallow, which is enough to replenish the fertility of the soil in this environment. Regardless of that, and even though they are pretty well off compared to other families in the Altiplano, they still have high perceptions of risk with regards to their livelihoods. In the northern Altiplano, where you see the changing climate and the temperature rising and the crops changing, you find also that there are a lot of impacts and losses to the families due to crops and pests, and they are experiencing, 50% of the families experience losses due to frost, and 50% of the families lose animals. And this is, again, particularly for 1 year. So you're talking about people that save their income in animals, and losing animals means losing your bank account. So again, a high degree of vulnerability in this particular context. When you have these contexts, and this is a picture of all these landscapes that I show you, basically showing the degree of perceived threat to families of these events, the closer you get to red is a really extreme threat to their livelihood, to their survival. Those areas that you see in blue and white, which are not there, would be low levels of threat or no threat to their livelihoods. So people are making decisions faced by multiple threats to their livelihoods, both from the markets — the markets don't work very well, but also from all these climatic events, from pests and diseases, which are really a high degree of loss for the families after post-harvest, and from the vulnerability of an adult becoming sick. So if a member of your family becomes sick, you are in peril. And this happens because you don't have insurance mechanisms like you find here. So both what we also studied is how men and women feel about these events, because many of the decision makers in farming are women. And we also see that both in the men and women farming in these areas feel no sense of control of these climatic events that are impacting their crops and animals. This is not an exception. If you go to Africa, you find the same context. And in Africa, we were working with our colleagues at the Kenyan Agricultural Research Institute in the coast, in the semi-arid environments near Machakos, working with farmers to understand what were their concerns with their livelihoods, what were they seeking to achieve, and how new innovations like GM crops would help their livelihoods. What we find is that in these environments, again, families are constantly affected by drought events, by El Niño events. So the larger you see the word there, I just did a word cloud of the things that people were sharing through these participatory research meetings, where we were able to group people that were more vulnerable and less vulnerable, and by gender. And we consistently find that they recall a lot of shocks that have impacted their livelihoods, and also that their context and in which they are making decisions is a very vulnerable context. Their levels of incomes are lower than the ones that you've seen in the Altiplano region, or that I've shown in the Altiplano region, because you're really closer here to $1 to $2 a day as opposed to $3 a day, which is the case of the Altiplano region. Why is this important? The people that have studied decision making under uncertainty show that people assess risks in several ways. So as scientists, figure out risks by rules, by our science. We look at the thresholds and we evaluate those. And we also have other ways of learning about those risks and negotiating those risks, which is this tacit knowledge that we develop. And so people use both normally to address those. Most of us probably are combining what the climatologist tells us about today is going to rain and what we feel is going to happen. And we probably, well, most of us probably carry an umbrella if the climatologist said that. But in many other places, when you are in this context where there is a lot of uncertainty and risk, people trust more their tacit knowledge than the knowledge that comes from the outside. So when we think about bringing new technologies and innovations and designing new systems for decision makers, we really have to understand how to work with those decision makers in order for that knowledge that we're generating to be useful in their decision-making process. In the Andes, for example, there is a conflict. If there is a conflict between their local knowledge, those indicators that they're showing them what's going to happen with the planting season and what the weather organization is telling them, they trust their local knowledge. They don't trust yet the weather organization. And there are many reasons for that. It's a knowledge that's foreign to them. There is no relationship between them. It's not, there is not that connectedness that we can find here, that I know my meteorologist and I will follow him because I get good information from him, right? In these contexts, that doesn't happen. So I don't trust the knowledge that's coming from the outside, because the risk that I would be taking would mean food insecurity for my family. So in thinking about working in developing countries and in rural areas where there is high levels of risk, there are ways of working together that actually link or help connect those knowledge systems. And working through participatory processes, for example, Pat and others in Africa have shown that there is a possibility for connecting the knowledge and climate forecast information with the knowledge that the farmers have. We also find, though, that in many places that the meteorologists and the climate scientists acknowledge that they don't have the skill to work in those areas. So in the Altiplano, where you have a high variability in altitude and microclimates, actually what our colleagues are doing is working in a network of collaboration with the farmers so that there is more feedback between the scientists that want to find out what's going on the ground and the farmers that are observing those. And a colleague, Jerry Gillis at University of Missouri, is working on that. So translational research approaches mean exactly that we need to develop what we call meaningful knowledge. Meaningful knowledge meaning actionable knowledge. So it has to be salient to the decision maker. It has to be in the language and context and culture of the decision maker. And it has to come from a trusted source. In many of the processes, and this is significant because if we see the projections for this particular regions, there will be fast-paced changes in the Altiplano. The studies on extremes are showing that the extremes are going to increase, the extreme events in temperature and in frosts and in intensity of precipitation and expansion of the drought periods are going to increase. And so in those particular areas, we need to be able to link the knowledge that has been developed locally for adaptation from the knowledge that's coming from the outside. There is many of the scientists that are working in this area don't have a solution, but working together with those that are making decisions, we believe, is a way of trying to build that bridge and create more knowledge that's trustable. How we have been engaging in this is through participatory processes, working with community organizations, working with associations and farmer groups, working with institutions that are already on the ground, and thinking about the way we work together, because in many parts of the world, there are power issues in terms of the vulnerable that don't have the resources nor access to the politics, and then the scientists that have more power in those structures. And so we work together trying to figure out how to develop new, what we call practices, communities of practice, where people can work together from the science, from other stakeholders and the local decision makers, and really understanding what type of knowledge can contribute to the adaptation and resilience of their systems. An example that we worked in the SAMRIM CRISP, Sustainable Ag and Natural Resource Management CRISP, in this area was related to soils, because soils is a key resource in this environment. And not only a key resource, but it has the value of being Pachamama, or Mother Earth, culturally for the Aymara and the Quechua people in the Andes. So working with them, we learned, and this is the royal we, because we is also Peter Muravalli and others, about the characteristics of the soils and the practices that they implemented and what other practices they wanted to try out in order to figure out how they would work in their own context. And then evaluating together with them which practices would be the ones that would be sustainable. And it's interesting, and not only interesting, one of the big contradictions that we have here is that the market drivers, the lack of integration of these communities with the mainstream, and with all these policies that we talk about adaptation, those policies never reach them. And the practices that they have, that they're losing, are exactly the practices that can build that buffer in the soil. They have done soil amendment practices and management of soils for centuries, more than centuries. And they're losing those practices driven by the market. So translational research processes, and this is an example of what we did in Kenya, engage not only the farmers, engage the universities, engage our students, engage the organizations that are working on the ground to develop processes in which we develop a two-way system of creating knowledge rather than a one-way system of creating information. And what we find is that the way you engage matters. When we engage with interest groups, what we see is that only the people that have the means to work on improved potatoes participate, but the vulnerable farmers can't. When we work with organizations, and normally the institutions in the highlands have a way of including everybody, we find that more of that information flows throughout the members of the communities. So we look at the networks and see how that information is flowing and how much people can practice that new knowledge. I think that in our way forward, and we were discussing this also at the conference that we just had in the Transitional Syrian Systems to Adapt to Climate Change Conference, is that there is this acknowledgement that we need to figure out how to create sustainable means of for this process to take place. And the best place to start is with the local institutions that will be there for long term. So in our country, soil conservation, for example, organizations that are working locally are the ones that would be there and fund it forever, right? Not like us that come with a project and develop a project and then leave. for us, it was very important to work with the universities and the communities themselves and link them to government, because those networks also are not there necessarily. So you need to foster those. And also to remember that in these uncertain worlds where there are fast changes, the decisions are going to make locally. It's local decision makers that will make those decisions of the practices that we're talking about. So like in Australia, there's a close work with the farmers. In many other parts of the world, that doesn't happen. And we think about the need for increasing production for the 9 or 12 billion in the world, but if of that proportion, a high proportion are smallholder farmers in the world, then we need to start working with them in terms of figuring out that pathway for integrated development. That's it. It is ironic, I agree. I mean, there are perverse incentives that make us behave in a certain way, and subsidies may make us feel that we're protected, and therefore we will continue to do what we're doing. And in other parts of the world, those incentives don't exist, but because of the fact that you are living at a threshold of vulnerability, you also are not able to address them. So we need to think differently, definitely, as we move forward if we want adaptation to take place and build resilience.
And this is an example. We have this big farm show in Ontario every year. And at the conclusion of the farm show a couple of years ago, I was wandering around, and one of the tillage equipment guys came up to talk to me, and he essentially told me to shut up out in the farm communities because, don't talk no-till and conservation till, because we have a livelihood to have out here to support our families and our children to sell farm equipment. And I was just so shocked by that comment. I didn't know how to react.
Yes.
What are the main reasons that we're moving away from
the traditional potato? On the one hand, they are integrating little by little into the markets, but the markets don't function very well. So what they get from whatever they're trying to sell doesn't necessarily cover their costs. They may cover their inputs if they use them, and whatever they're not being able to cover is basically work that they're giving out for free, right, through their farming. So you have that process happening, and that's pushing farmers, part of the family members, to migrate off the farm. If you migrate off the farm and you need to manage peat bogs to ensure that the water is flowing, that's a very labor-intensive activity. And normally are women or the elderly that are left behind. The only places where you see growth and resilience in the ecosystem is in those areas where there has been a systematic and integrated way of development, which is in the dairy system. Because you see there that there were price support systems to make sure that the people producing and selling milk to the market would have enough for their livelihoods. At the same time, you had seeds and knowledge that was given to work on the improvement of the pasture so that the animals would have higher productivity of milk. And you had marketing systems, the constructions of roads. I tell my students that when I started working in that area, people to get to the market required 5 hours, and now they take 30 minutes. And the difference is the roads. So that building of infrastructure allowed for farmers to continue to live in rural communities and to create, in this particular area, actually, you see rural development happening. so integrated rural development. While in other areas, like the area where people are either only having camelids like alpacas, or the people that only do smallholder crops are not able to really get a return for all the work that they do. And that pushes people out in the inability of having that human power, that labor, to be able to do that. And mechanization in those contexts is not going to solve the problem. The problem, in many cases, is a problem of institutions and markets that are creating disincentives for people. We call them disincentives, but inability for the families to continue to maintain that those practices.
Okay, I don't know if